tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
When you meet Errol Nemhard, the first thing that hits you isn't his title or resume. It's the quiet weight of purpose. Born in the UK to Jamaican roots, he chose 1994 South Africa, a time of rebirth, as his stage. Since then, he hasn't just forged a career, he's architected transformation across industries and lives. A business architect with blue chip gravitas, Errol serves as Chief Commercial Officer at the Pacific Institute Africa, now the K3Y, mobilizing leaders across Africa to unlock opportunity for 2 billion lives. But his story isn't bound by boardrooms, it's defined by principles. By faith, inspired by what some might call a spiritual journey he and his wife took in 1992, arriving in Africa without tickets, trusting they'd be led. It's shaped by mentorship under Ambassador Andrew Young, sharpening his understanding of leadership as a calling and not a career. And it's guided by the belief that if you want generational impact, you need to serve with humility, wisdom, and get this, rest. Tonight we go beneath the titles and timelines. We go to the roots, the heart, the ripple effect, and we ask, how did he become? What is he building? And where is he taking it all? And us next. Errol, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mpumi.
How do you do?
Pleasure indeed. I'm well, thank you. Well indeed.
Alrighty. I am always fascinated whenever I'm interviewing incredible men like yourself. The first thought that comes to mind is, what was the 10-year-old you thinking about when you thought about your future and what you wanted to achieve? Never mind what was around you. What are the dreams and the thoughts that 10-year-old Errol had?
Wow, that's an interesting question, because that's kind of really going back like 50 years now.
I know.
and, you know, 50 years ago, you know, the memory is a little dim.
Yes.
In that regard. But, you know, when you're 10 years old in Birmingham, Handsworth, the United Kingdom, I mean, at that time, I wouldn't say that I had goals, dreams, and expectations. Mm-hmm. I think I was just enjoying childhood.
Okay.
You know, just enjoying school, friends. The general things that happen when you're about 10, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, looking forward to your birthdays and your Christmases, mm-hmm. and your Easters, and when your uncles and aunts come around and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that I really then at that point had any major dreams or so forth. I enjoyed sport. I think it was when I was about 11 I picked up basketball after the Harlem Globetrotters came to England. And I saw Curly Nielsen. He was an amazing basketball player, but he was part of the Harlem Globetrotters. Mm. And I'd picked up basketball from about the age of 11. And I thought that my journey was around basketball, because I went on to become the captain of the school basketball team.
Okay.
Then went on, played on for the district. And then when I went on to play semi-professional with the West Bromwich Wildcats. But, you know, going back to 10, I wouldn't say that I had a very clear or any form of dream, to be honest.
And when did you then begin to dream about how you wanted to impact the world, if that time ever came when you were younger?
I think you know, the first pieces of that journey sort of emerged when, number one, we were in Shepherd's Bush in London at an evangelistic crusade that was being run by Elder Fitzhenry, Elder Fitzhenry.
Yes, I remember.
From Jamaica.
Yes.
Yeah, and this was, I mean, we were quite young people at the time, but this was the first time I'd ever seen someone who had a combination of being a preacher of the gospel and yet a businessman simultaneously. I mean, that was something that was never seen before. It was unusual. It was novel, because the mere fact that if you could preach, the assumption was that you had the gift of preaching and therefore you must go to theology school.
Of course, of course.
And the idea was that business and preaching did not mix. Mm-hmm. There were two separate parallel paths.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first time in Shepherd's Bush, I remember seeing this man who is a justice of the peace, but he was also a preacher and also a businessman in construction. that was really new. It was really new.
Yeah, that explains
and
so much that I've come to learn about you just from observing. Yeah. Now, you arrive in South
Yeah.
Africa in 1994, a year of seismic change for this country, might I add. What
Indeed.
did that
Yeah.
decision teach you about, firstly, identity, then belonging, and I think lastly, the thing you're talking about now, which is calling?
Yeah, listen. 1994 was a real pivotal year for this country, but in 1993, it was a pivotal year for us because that was where I was a housing officer at the time. I actually, was selected to participate in a program in which it was a scholarship for young black people who didn't necessarily have the skills and qualifications to get into social housing, but had the aptitude to. And so I was one of the first 10 to get a scholarship into that space. And that was probably back in 92. But then I felt God calling me in 93 to give up that which I assumed at that time was where my identity was. And my identity was locked in the fact that I was now a housing officer, moving on. They were promoting me. And now suddenly I felt the Lord was saying, no, my identity is not in that. My identity is in him. And he's got another plan for me. And we never thought that South Africa was in that ballpark at all, not even Africa, but it seemed that that's where God wanted us to be. And for my whole family at the time, my wife, my kids were what, 3 and 4 at the time when we came. And I, when I look back at it now, 9th of August coming up in a bit of a while, I would have been here 30, what, 2 years,
31,
31 years, something like that. Yeah. So, I think that, God has taught me that your identity is not wrapped up in your vocation. Your identity is not wrapped up in your title or your status or your position, because those things are transient and can go. And what is left if you don't have your identity in God? You have nothing.
Nothing at all.
So I found that having stepped away from that and to come into South Africa, for many people with no rhyme or no reason other than this burden to share the gospel. And even then, the notion of business was not part of the equation. It was 4 years of missionary work, not for a conference, not for employment by anyone, but I really felt that I was employed by God, and he blessed those 4 years in which I said to God, listen, I'm going to give you 4 years of my life, a tithe of my time. It was a real blessing. I saw God show up in major, major ways.
It's interesting that you are mentioning the 4 years because I
Yeah.
had gone to Metro, I think this one time, and I was like, oh, mom, you know who's the elder there? Elder Errol. And my mom's like, oh, wait, Errol, show me a picture. And I show her a picture, and she's like, I know this guy. I remember how fervent he was for the gospel. And in that same sentence, we mentioned Fitzhenry. And it's so interesting because I remember quite vividly, and I was only 4 in 1998 when we had Pentecost
Wow.
98.
In
And
98,
so
that's right,
to
yeah.
hear you talk about Fitzhenry and him being such an influence in your life, and then the 4 years leading up to Pentecost 98 with him, for me, sounds like a full circle moment, and I'm not even the one in the
Yeah.
circle.
Yeah, and we spent a lot of time together in Pentecost 98. It was an amazing time to reconnect with him. And he came subsequently many times after that. But it was really good. Yeah, definitely.
But I do want to take you to the 2 years before 94, when what you detail in your memoir style podcast as you coming into Africa without tickets, deeply trusting. What did that act of faith engineer within you?
Well, there's a couple of things. One of the things I've always believed is that faith does not have a backup plan. Okay. And if you're trusting in God, trust in him wholly and fully. And for many people, they would look at, turning up to an airport with no money, no tickets, with your wife, your children, and 3 friends believing they're coming to do missionary work as absolutely foolhardy. And from the outside, I would agree, it does look
It
foolhardy.
does. It looks
Unless
reckless.
God has put some clear things in front of you to guide you to say, this is the way, walk ye in it. Like, the children of Israel going to the Red Sea kind of looks foolhardy, right? You could have taken a different route, but God was leading them. And in the same way, when I quit my job, I knew this was God speaking to me. I'd triangulated, if you please, many times of fasting and prayer and then testing, the fleece type of dynamic. And God was showing up each time, demonstrating to me that this was
It's
something
him.
I needed to step into.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it was not easy because it's counter to take your family or children to do something of that significance and it work out, because ultimately, fundamentally the money was provided for the tickets, but it's not that we didn't spend 24 hours at the airport first waiting for God to show up. And God did show up in very strange and different ways. And so when I look at those 2 years prior, when I look at the fact that, my pastor had, and back in those days, pastors were at least our pastor was very different. He believed that we should not call international speakers to come and do crusades. He believed that it was important as a pastor to develop the young people in the church to become preachers. So he invested a lot of time in many of us as young people. And when the church decided they wanted a campaign and the church made a decision that I was going to be leading out, the pastor, Pastor Anderson at the time, he invested so much time in my development, and he became the Bible worker and then called other Bible workers from New Cobalt College who were on their summer break to become Bible workers. And he was going to guide me through that. And I don't know if that happens much anymore these days, but he was such a prolific influence in both my preaching style, preaching approach, the contemporary approach. He was very influential in that, because I didn't necessarily go to the school of the prophets. I didn't go to get a degree, if you please. I didn't secure a degree in theology, but God had a different plan and a different route. And it felt very much like how Fitz Henry was sort of fulfilling the gospel commission whilst at the very same time doing business. Now, I didn't pick up business until 1998, right? So it wasn't as if I had business in mind. It's just that I felt comfortable being able to do business because I had a previous or some experience of seeing someone else do that and be able to fulfill the commission that God had given them and not lose themselves by going into business, but still being able to synthesize the two worlds into one.
And I'm so before I even move to this, because I'm very intrigued by it. So I'm pretty sure there's somebody who's trying to hear from God about what their next move should be in their career. Perhaps that should be a business, or they should move to a different organization and all of that. And to hear you sound, or to hear you say so confidently and so clearly that you knew that it was God tugging at your heartstrings for you to make that move, how are you able to differentiate? And maybe this is for everyone who's listening, and I can trust you to share this because you are a minister of God's gospel. What are the things that people need to be conscious of and maybe even aware of to help them determine that this is God pointing them in this direction and maybe not what they're seeing online or something that they desire but isn't of God?
You know, the word of God tells us, in all thy ways acknowledge him and he will direct your
Direct.
path, right? He says if any of us lack wisdom,
We should
we must
ask.
ask, and he liberally gives that without condition. And I think the other side of it as well is that he doesn't ask us to be foolhardy in any decision, where because he gives little drops of information
This
along
is
the way to
true.
guide us. He doesn't leave us in a vacuum, so it may be through people in an unexpected ways, triangulating and coordinating with your perplexity, and suddenly a shaft of light through what you somebody comes and shares with you, or a set of circumstances. And when you triangulate all of those things, it becomes very clear that God is leading. Because if I'm asking him fleece wise, okay, God, you really sure I'm supposed to do this, right? What about this? What about this? He has no problem, you coming and saying, what's your fleece? Okay, just if you need to know, right? Or he may turn and bring people into your life that give you a word in season who does not know what
What
you're
is
going
going
through.
on?
And again, it's triangulating these points of information that now begin to give you insight to say, okay, God, this is where you want me to go. It's not being explicitly said. And then I go to the Word and I look for stories in the Bible. Was anybody going through anything similar like this? Was it God asking to do anything similar? And yet there were questions. And how did God? Because that's what the Bible is there for. It's to give us insight into the multiple different ways and permutations in which God acts. And it's never linear. It will always be unique to you. But there are principles that still remain. The Word of God as your guide. The scriptures that teach us how to look at how God speaks to us. The Holy Spirit. And God will use people at different points.
I believe this to be so true because this literally happened with me last week. I even said to this lady, when they talk about prophetic timing, I used to be like, oh, woo, woo, we don't talk about those things here in the church. But I really believe that it couldn't be anything else or anybody else that led her, the lady who spoke to me, to talk to me exactly what it is that she said. So I absolutely believe what you're saying to be true. And now it's 98. You are making this transition. What happens? What do you get into? Where does this confidence come from?
Well, you know, after the 4 years of missionary touring, I you know, my simple view was, and for as a family, that I needed to also supply the needs of my family. And not that I'm a provider, because God is our provider. He simply provides for us to steward what we have well, right? So let's just not get it twisted. I'm not a provider. Right? Let's be clear. But I knew that I needed to participate in this other side of life without losing the fervor for missionary, the work, the gospel, and so forth. And it was interesting because it was actually 1998 while Fitzhenry was doing Pentecost 1998. Just before Pentecost 98, I was doing a bit of a tour over a six-week period, preaching in multiple churches, doing week of prayers in Port Elizabeth and so forth. And at the same time, I'd put down a very clear, you know, what do I want? And placing that before the Lord. And I wanted to really get into a space where I could make a difference in the lives of people, where I could, you know, influence thinking, help to shift behavior. And whilst I didn't come from a neuroscientific or psychological background, the Bible is full of psychology. And so at the same time, though, I didn't want a job. I wanted the freedom to be able, at the call of the Lord, to go and preach somewhere, which would be problematic if I had a full-time job. Right? And my wife said to me, Errol, I think you're crazy. I think you're, you know, you're being a bit too prescriptive with the list that you are expecting from God. But I said, babe, is anything too hard for the Lord? That's what he said to Abraham. Is anything too hard? So it says, I must lay it before him. If he thinks it's crazy, go for it, you know, but at least let me put it on the table. And you know what happened was that one night I came home from preaching and my wife was listening on the radio. Check this out. She was listening on the radio. I don't know what channel it was, but the there was an interview between the person and the MD of a company known as the Pacific Institute. And there was something that piqued Paulette's interest in that interview, because he said all true and meaningful and lasting change starts first on the inside and works its way out.
And this Paulette is being said, heard by Paulette, not you.
Not me. I was out preaching. Right? And Paulette said, but that is what, Errol, this is what you've been preaching about. That change starts on the inside, not the outside. And so that's what connected her to this this interview. And she was so interested. And then the person left their number and said, listen, contact the Pacific Institute. So she, I come home exhausted after preaching. And she says, I've got the thing that you're supposed to do. I know this is God. I said, sorry, what? She said, please call this number. And I said, call who? And she said, this number, the Pacific Institute. I said, but why? Did they call my name?
You know?
She said, no. They say all true and meaningful and lasting change starts first on the inside and works its way out. And that's what you've been talking about. So I said, well, okay, I'm not sure what this is about. So I phoned, the next day I phone, and this lady answers the phone and she turns around and she thinks, because of my accent and the fact that I'm not born in South Africa, that clearly I'm Caucasian. And she says, you know, but actually We're looking for people of color.
Yeah.
And I said, well,
I
I am
am
a
a
person
person
of
of
color.
color.
You know, so she said, oh, are you? I said, yes, this is 98. She said, would you come to the office? And I came to the office, and there's this, it's an amazing work. It's a business that's been around in the US and so forth. He was the former strategic human resource director of Nedcor Bank, saw the this massive intervention in Nedcor that changed his life, and then he went and bought the business and brought it to South Africa. His name was Brian Wegley. And so literally in a few weeks, he said to me, would you like to join this business? I said, well, no, because I don't want a job. He said, well, what do you want? I said, I wanted the ability to go and do mission work whenever God calls me. He said, fine. He says, well, don't you want a salary? I said, no, I'll take commission. He says, okay. He said, well, you know, do you really want to do this? I said, yes, because it has all the hallmarks of what I've been looking for in terms of making a difference in the way people think and act and behave. And he says, okay. And literally for the next, from 1998 to 2006, Brian Wegley taught me everything that I could have ever known in this business, sent me to the US, sent me to Europe, sat at the feet of some of the biggest thinkers in the field of cognitive psychology and organizational development. And in about 2004, he then offered me to be a partner and shareholder in the business. And 2 years later, tragically, he died on a bike accident. He had bought Harley Davidson, and he bought Harley Davidson because he wanted to minister to the bikers. And so he bought the Harley Davidson in Sandton, in Cape Town, in Durban. And he was having, he's a deeply Christian man. And he died suddenly, leaving me and one or two of my other colleagues to lead and grow the business. And just recently in 2000, two years ago, we renamed the Pacific Institute to The Key, K3Y, the Key.
The
And the
key.
three means body, soul, and spirit.
Now talk to me about that. It's such a great segue into what I did want to ask. As the CCO now, I believe your goal is to unlock opportunity for billions. You're not
Yeah,
talking
you know.
thousands, and you're talking about the whole world. Billions is literally
Yeah,
the whole
yeah.
world. Is it possible for you to share a breakthrough moment, perhaps, when
Yeah,
that
yeah.
shifted from goal to reality?
Yeah. Well, you know, for since 1998, we've been touching lives in the corporate space, bringing humanity back to the workplace, understanding the correlation between leadership and people impact. The world we're living in today is very, very toxic, and we have very toxic leaders, as a generalization. Yet there is leadership practice that brings the best out of people and gives them the ability for discretionary performance. And so the work that we've been doing through neuroscience, cognitive psychology, is helping leaders, teams, individuals, and organizations accelerate their growth and their profitability, ultimately, because businesses need to survive, and it survives through the people. But you see, with the technological revolution that took place pre and specifically post-COVID, now the access to AI and the underpinning technologies means that the scale and reach of being able to reach people by
Is
digitizing our products and
broader.
services means that you have deeper penetration at a faster rate than ever before on our planet, simply because of where technology is. And so by harnessing technology and being able to then integrate that with the human factor in terms of growth and learning, we're able to reach so much more people than we ever thought possible. And hence the reason we really felt as a team, as an organization, that our legacy, beyond me and beyond those who are existing in the organization, we want to hit 2 billion lives. Because at the end of the day, it's possible. And it's possible because we now have the technological advancements to be able to create that level of reach that could never be considered even 10 years ago. You know, so that's kind of where we're at. And, you know, we work with a lot of blue chip companies across the continent. We're actually doing a major conference in Eswatini just in the next 2 days. We're having my good friend Vusi Tembakwayo, who's an international speaker, and we, you know, he's coming to speak at our Unlock conference in Eswatini, which is taking place on the 9th.
That sounds so amazing.
So that just, yeah. Go on.
And is there a moment where you were just like, oh man, this is purpose. I'm doing exactly what I was designed to do.
Well, from 1998, I knew this was purpose because
yeah.
for me, work and ministry should be synonymous. There should be no differentiation between one's vocation and how one acts, behaves, works in one's vocation and church or ministry or giftings.
Yeah.
And for me, I know I'm in the perfect space because what I do from the pulpit or whether we're doing marriage counseling or whether I'm doing in the church space versus what I'm doing or my organization is doing, because it's not so much me anymore as is the organization. It's impacting hearts and minds for phenomenal change.
Yeah.
Having watched, because I can't necessarily bring the gospel in the corporate space, but I can bring the principles of the gospel that brings humanity into a place of understanding, how do we lead and how do we impact people for good? And that for me is as good as the gospel as well, because 100%. It's about impact.
Yeah, it sounds sounds like when someone's watching, they don't know for you where ministry stops and the work begins because it's all one thing.
It doesn't stop.
Yeah.
It's all one thing.
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm able to help an organization move from 300 million to 1.5 billion profit after tax in 1,500 days, because they look at their people and work with their people differently, creating high performance and discretionary performance in the people to be able to want to, like to, love to do what they do.
Yeah.
Aren't we making the world a better place? Oh, 100%. Are we making organizations a better place?
100%.
That's what I do.
It sounds like I'm hearing myself, because you mentioned 5 decades and I'm still 30. So it sounds like I'm hearing myself 2 decades from now, rather, because what you're saying, I believe at the core, I believe it fundamentally. In fact, I remember 5 years ago, I started a business called Purpose Practitioners Club, because I really believe that if there's anything we're going to be doing with our lives while we're here on earth, it's the very thing we were put on this earth for. And that whenever somebody asks, what do you do? I'm a purpose practitioner. That is my profession, doing what my purpose is.
Yes, indeed, indeed.
It would be so remiss of me if we had this conversation and I didn't bring this particular point into it. You've spoken about rest as a leadership act. How do you build regimes and not retreats into your rhythm as a leader?
You know, I suppose rest is important. And let me just bring what I sort of my practice. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm part of what they known in the corporate world as the 5 a.m. club.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm up at 4:40 every morning, Monday to Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Make sure that 5 o'clock we hit the gym. Paulette's going to go swimming, do her 50 lengths. I'm going to do some HIIT work, or I'm going to do some sort of CrossFit works or High Rocks work. For that hour. So that's the health stuff. Come back, we have worship, enjoy worship, and then step into the world of work.
Yeah.
But my belief is that we don't need to have 9-to-5s. We need to have highly accountable people who produce the outcome that is required, not the time that it takes you to do it. So if you can do what you do, does that make sense?
Yeah.
In a shorter period of time, but produce the outcome.
Yeah.
I'm happy. Does that make sense? 100%. I don't need nobody doing no 9-to-5, 9-to-6.
Yeah.
So being able to harmonize work and life is critical, but also the notion of rest.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening in our society, and I think we're taking a lot from Western society, to be honest, is this notion that, you know, in order to grow and thrive, you got to work not only the period of time that you have, but you sacrifice your family and sacrifice your health and sacrifice your children and in order to make it. And
hustle,
I don't believe
hustle,
that was God's
hustle.
Agenda. And
I'll rest
that
when I'm
hustle,
dead.
Exactly. I do not believe in that. I don't believe for a second that's what God intended for us. He intended for us to utilize our gifts and our talents to work. And he provides the increase and we are meant to steward it, right? So in other words, we've got to think smarter, not necessarily work harder. And so we must then, if we can, then find that harmonious interplay between work and rest. And then obviously when it comes to Sabbath, Sabbath then, you know, is a really good space in which now to cease even from the thought of labor, you know? And I think too often we arrive at the Sabbath and we literally screech towards the sunset, and even then our minds overshoot and we're constantly still thinking about what we should have done, what we didn't do, what still has to be done, where God is saying, come and rest.
Come and rest.
Right? But we have rest inside of the week, and then we have the penultimate rest, which is on Sabbath.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm a big proponent of that because I think it's part of the health message, to be honest.
100%. What do you think we are fundamentally misunderstanding that has driven us into this hustle, hustle, hustle culture? What don't we know that if you were to share with somebody right now would absolutely revolutionize their thinking?
I think it's an erroneous belief that it's, if it's going to be, it's up to me.
Ooh.
I think we've got this Invictus type mindset that says,
I'm
it's
all
me,
of God.
Myself, and I.
Yeah.
And I think we're completely missing it when we got to understand that God is the means by which he orchestrates circumstances.
Mm.
Should we work? Yes. Do we need to work? Yes. But this notion that it's up to me, I think is a misnomer.
Yeah.
I personally think, because you know, we are supposed to, almost like a Rubik's cube, we are called to use our brain to solve problems, right? And at the end of the day, the products and services that we bring to society are meant to solve problems at the end of the day, right? But if we think for a minute that the gift and the talent and the skills and the energy that we have is comes from ourselves, that's where we're missing it. And that's why we struggle then to rest or to step back and trust God, because we think it has everything to do with us. And so it's me, myself, and I, and maybe God.
Yeah, if he's lucky. you know what you're saying reminds me of the instance where Jethro was looking at Moses judging all the cases. And he said to him, dude, You're going to have to use some of the elders to do some of the work, because you can't do it alone.
Yeah.
And when I hear you talk about, we think all of it starts and ends with us, whereas we have community, we have God with the inception, and you know, the leader of it all. But when I think about this hustle culture, I'm literally just seeing one person sweating and burning out on their own.
That's the right people
who get to build really meaningful, sustainable organizations are those who realize the power of community.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. You know, this idea of it's got to be me. I mean, you know, I couldn't dream of what I'm doing today if we didn't build people into the ecosystem with a passion and a purpose and a vision around that future. Build the right sort of infrastructure and technologies to support them, and then lead by connecting the dots, energizing the system, and nurturing growth.
Yeah.
Because that's the role of leadership.
100%.
But the hustle culture for me, it's about me trying to do it. You can't scale as an individual. Maybe with AI today, they're saying that you're going to get tech trillionaires who are sitting in some basement with a computer simply because of the accessibility of artificial intelligence to integrate much of the manual labor that typically exists in our world today. That may be possible, who knows, but I still believe that God designed us for community, not for isolation.
This is so true, so true. And I realize we have to wrap this conversation up, but I do want to ask you two important questions before we do. So you're leading, you're building, you're stewarding, and you're really doing well in the business and the ministry, which is really one thing that you are doing. When you when you look back, when you sit down perhaps on a Sunday or on vacation, and you think about the next chapter, and whether this is personally, professionally, and spiritually, what does it look like? How does it read?
You know, for Paulus and I right now, you know, we have such an interest in families. You know, part of ministry for me is never going to end, but I've realized that, you know, when we think of attachment theory, we think of the way in which we've been brought up, we think about the way it's impacted us, not because our parents were bad or anything, but they just didn't know any better. And how we carry that on into then relationships. And how then we are experiencing and watching how marriages are crumbling, and they're crumbling for no other reason than they fail to understand the dynamics that gave rise to how they have trigger points. And we've got a serious passion around working with families, hence the reason we get invited to Australia, the Caribbean, UK, various other parts of the world to share our insights around family life. And I'm really passionate about that. I don't know if it's a transition of where I'm going, but it's something that's really building and something we're very, really, really passionate about. I think from a business perspective, I don't think I'll ever stop doing business because I think to continue to create, we're called to create. And I think that I won't want to stop that. I'll probably, if I have my own way, by God's grace, I'd transition out of the operational side of the business into a more board director type thing. But I think that at the end of the day, though, meaningfully enabling families and helping them to get through the more difficult period. After 37 years of being married ourselves, we've experienced quite a lot in that space. And we've shared a lot of our, vulnerably, our own story. But as we've begun studying for ourselves, understanding some of the theoretical models that have a very strong biblical basis to it, we feel very strongly that if we have a part to play in helping our communities in their relationships, because too many families are literally destructing, and it's not about the world or the church, both are experiencing it in exactly the same way now.
You mentioned attachment theory, and I was like, oh, I wish you knew how much I'm fighting for my life with my avoidant attachment style. I'm fighting
That's
for
the style,
my
exactly.
life. Ah,
You know?
because now I'm aware, and the knowledge alone isn't enough. I need to actively fight against the fact that I'm dismissive. I'm avoidant.
And that's the point. I mean, to get into a secure attachment style, coming away from avoidant or chaotic or vacillating or pleaser. I mean, I myself discovered I was an avoidant, and I was like, "What, me?" But then I could see it, and then you suddenly begin to see how the imprint on your own upbringing has created the triggers that cause you to behave the way you're behaving. And
100%.
I see it as God's way of saying, "This is the next stage of the unlock of what I want you to be. Is these are some of the stones in your life that needs to be removed in order for you to become a better version of what I intended you to be than what you are right now." So I see it as all part of the process of sanctification by discovering aspects of ourselves
For
that
sure.
we never knew, but God is revealing through opportunities like what we're discovering and talking about today.
For sure. And let's close this book this way. What story would you most want your grandchildren to tell should they inherit the pages of your life?
The story I'd like my grandchildren to have, and I'm waiting for my grandchildren, by the way.
They're coming.
Son's married and so forth, so we're waiting. But I think, I think it's more around that faith is manifested through obedience. Obedience has no value unless it is it is linked to faith. And what I want my grandchildren to understand is that obedience and faith can take you places that you could never imagine, because it unlocks God's ability to do for you far more exceeding abundantly than you could think or ask. That's what I'd like them to understand and know.
For me, throughout this conversation, we walked with you from Fate's first leap to Africa's boardrooms, and now where there are organizational breakthroughs because of that very obedience that you spoke of. When I hear you speak, I'm hearing a leader who builds systems and souls. And I think a lot of people don't realize that the two can work hand in hand. In fact, they enhance each other if they work symbiotically. And you write strategies and scripture, and you understand that legacy isn't inherited, but it's really stewarded.
No.
And so I really want
Yes.
to thank you for reminding us that leadership doesn't require you to be louder. It just wants you to go
Yeah.
deeper. And that to
Exactly.
unlock opportunity for the billions you spoke of, we must first unlock it within ourselves. And that is the work
Yeah.
that when you mentioned your next chapter, I was seeing as you were speaking. So thank you so much for holding our
It's a
hand as you
pleasure.
were walking us to back to what, 50 years ago, and you thought, no, I
Eish,
couldn't do this,
yeah.
but you remembered the details so well. And I normally like starting there because those details, when you look at them, really speak to the person that you are today.
Yeah.
And the person you are today is blessing us. So thank you so, so much.
Pleasure indeed. Pleasure indeed.
It
Thank
was
you so
lovely
much for
having
the
this
opportunity.
conversation.
Indeed, and to the listeners also.
Thank you
Thank you.
so much.
All right then.
Cheers.
Cheers, cheers.
And with that, I am Nompumelelo Mbonani, and I hope you've just made sense of your business, or better yet, found your own business and your own journey. Fresh mercies tomorrow. Ciao for now.
Do you want to make your money make sense? Listen to Business Sense every Monday to Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and make sense of your money.